From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We're days into a new month, and Dr. Deborah Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force warns that we're also in a new phase of the pandemic.
What we're seeing today is different from March and April. It is extraordinarily widespread. It's into the rural as equal urban areas. And to everybody who lives in a rural area, you are not immune or protected from this virus.
Birx told CNN that no matter where people live, they should wear a face mask and practice social distancing. Today, President Trump called her pathetic in a tweet. Joining us now is NPR's Eric Whitney, who's keeping an eye on the latest news about COVID-19 around the country. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, we just heard Dr. Birx mention the spread in rural areas. Give us more details about where we're seeing spikes in rural parts of this country.
So I'm based in Montana. It's a mostly rural state. And like a lot of rural states, we've had very low numbers until about June. And since then, we're seeing our overall case count grow exponentially, following rollbacks on restrictions on businesses and visitors. Last week, we saw a construction site at a mountain resort here blow up with more than 100 positive cases. I know there's people in tourist towns who are really concerned about all the out-of-state plates they're seeing across many states. Their frontline workers there are concerned about being exposed to the virus. A reporter in Tennessee tells me the outbreak there has now moved beyond Nashville and Memphis and become widespread across much of the state. And I think that's also the case in a lot of southern states with high infection rates like Mississippi and Alabama. Still pretty common to see big spikes in rural places with big meatpacking plants or other agricultural operations where people work closely together. Jails and prisons are often located in rural areas, and we're seeing spikes there too.
When you mentioned some of the states that are in the South, in fact, six of the top seven states in terms of the new cases are in the South, the other being California. Are things starting to level off at all in those states that have seen spikes in recent weeks?
Well, California's daily case count has dropped from a peak on July 25th of more than 10,000 new cases a day to about 6,400 yesterday. You know, that's good news, but it's far from assured that trend will continue. And 6,400 cases a day is still huge. That can spawn a lot of new spread. You know, Arizona has seen a more sustained drop recently. The state's weekly average of new cases has been going down since early July. But health officials in Arizona and even that state's conservative governor, Doug Ducey, are not saying that they're out of the woods yet. Governor Ducey paused his previous plans to continue broad reopening. Hospitals in Arizona have been strained. That's eased a little bit, but it's not over yet. And then if you look at test positivity rates in many southern states like Florida and South Carolina, they're often in the double digits. Mississippi's test positivity rate is over 20%. Georgia's is more than 12%. And public health officials say that anything over a 5% positivity rate is concerning. So I don't think we can say that things are leveling off in southern states.
Where are things improving in this country at this point?
In the Northeast, there are seven states in the District of Columbia that have seen things improve since spring. You know, they've successfully driven their new daily case counts down, often pretty dramatically. You know, New York is notable there, also New Jersey and Massachusetts. But again, there's no guarantee that those flattened curves are going to stay flat. You know, the health reporter there in Boston, Martha Biebinger, has told me that she's got real concerns about numbers going up in Massachusetts as restrictions there have loosened up. And we're also starting to see some uptick in cases in northeastern states in recent days.
What is going on, Eric, in terms of lockdown measures? You know, we've heard people say we might have to do something beyond just having everybody wear a mask. But has anybody been actually doing that and locking things back down?
Not broadly on a statewide basis. You know, restrictions and rollbacks are literally all over the map across the country and even within states. I think most notably, Alabama's governor has just extended her state's mask mandate through the end of this month. You know, she had resisted imposing statewide restrictions until the middle of July. Overall, in the last couple of weeks, it looks like some measures have been taken in about 10 states. Kentucky has reduced indoor dining limits from 50% to 25% capacity. The governor in Kentucky saying, quote, he will not let us become an Alabama or a Florida or an Arizona. Michigan has closed bars in the northern part of the state and reduced indoor gathering limits there. And even in states without statewide mandates, it's pretty common to see cities or smaller jurisdictions rolling back their own reopenings or imposing restrictions on their own. As I said, Arizona hasn't done a statewide mask mandate, but reporters there tell me nearly every local jurisdiction now has one, and they're taking measures to try to control the spread.
That is NPR's Eric Whitney. Eric, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
President Trump has given Microsoft until September 15th to negotiate a deal to buy a piece of TikTok. That's a step back from Trump's threat on Friday that he would ban the popular Chinese video app, which he calls a national security risk. Let's bring in Greg Roumiotis. He's an editor at Reuters and was one of the reporters who broke this story. And Greg, Microsoft said in a statement that it's committed to acquiring TikTok, but there are a few things that they first need to work out. What are some of the main concerns over the next few weeks?
So they need to convince U.S. national security officials that TikTok will not offer any backdoor to China's government were it to be separated from its current owner, ByteDance, and be owned by Microsoft. All of TikTok's data on American users is already stored in the United States, but because TikTok's platform, its algorithms, its code are shared by other ByteDance apps, U.S. officials need to be convinced that if there were to be a sale to Microsoft, ByteDance wouldn't be left holding the keys and still have access to the app.
Let's break that down just a little bit. So TikTok's parent company, which is a Chinese company, has taken steps in the past to try to appease U.S. regulators on this front, but President Trump still says it's a national security risk. Just remind us briefly how we got here.
So we at Reuters actually broke news last year that the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States had opened an investigation into TikTok. This is a U.S. government panel that scrutinizes deals for potential national security risks. But of course, what has happened since then is that relations between the United States and China have deteriorated. The president told reporters last week that he was actually looking at banning TikTok, but we reported yesterday that he will now allow the CFIUS process to run. And the CFIUS process will basically give 45 days for Microsoft and ByteDance to see if they can negotiate a deal that can, you know, appease U.S. national security officials.
Mm-hmm. So this Microsoft deal would involve them buying TikTok service here, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. So does that mean that this parent company would still operate the service in the rest of the world? How exactly would that work?
That's the key question. So we understand that as far as those countries are concerned, Microsoft would be taking over. But like the devil will be in the detail, because this is being done. So ByteDance will have, you know, no access, no backdoor to TikTok. And to be fair, that's probably why you saw the president and some officials in the White House not being able to make up their minds, because it's been like a very big question mark. Can, you know, the technology of TikTok really be taken away from ByteDance in a way that satisfies U.S. concerns?
Mm-hmm. Microsoft owns LinkedIn, but otherwise it isn't really well known as a social media space. How big of a deal would this acquisition of TikTok be for Microsoft? I mean, would it then put it in the same space to compete more directly with the Facebooks and the Snapchats of the world?
Absolutely. It would be transformative. And you may have noticed at the congressional hearings last week when four big technology company CEOs attracted the ire of, you know, lawmakers, Republican and Democrat, Microsoft wasn't there. Beyond LinkedIn, Microsoft mainly focuses on business software, and this, you know, an app that boasts 100 million users in the United States would, you know, give Microsoft one of, you know, the social media industry's gems and, you know, turn them into, you know, a very big player. So it'll be very interesting to see how the president navigates the politics of this deal with his own base. Many of his supporters are suspicious of big technology companies. They perceive an inherent bias against conservatives in social media. And at the same time, you probably saw over the weekend, many of his, you know, Republican supporters, you know, Lindsey Graham in particular, tweeting, making statements, encouraging the president to clinch this deal with Microsoft. So it will be very interesting to see how Trump navigates this.
Yeah, I mean, some of the speculation is that Trump backed off of earlier threats because it would alienate the party's younger users ahead of the election. Do you think that this deal will actually happen?
The big unknown here is this technological issues we discussed, this issue of absolute separation. Microsoft certainly has, you know, the cash to pay for this. The question is, can a deal be put together that appeases the China hawks in D.C.? Hmm.
That's Greg Roumiotis, editor of corporate finance and deals at Reuters. Greg, thank you.
Thank you. 'Cause all of me loves all of you. Love your curves and all your edges, all your perfect imperfections.
Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and Tony Award winner John Legend has been keeping busy during the pandemic. He's made appearances at virtual fundraisers, including one for Joe Biden. He has continued to serve as a coach on the latest season of The Voice, and he released a new album called Bigger Love. John Legend joins me now. Welcome. And it must be strange to release an album at a time like this.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because we didn't plan this album as an album that we would put out during a global pandemic. We wrote the songs in 2019, early 2020. But, you know, circumstances transpired the way that they did. And we had made an album that was full of love and joy and human connection, and we felt like it was the right music for the people right now.
Let's listen to a little bit of another song. This is Conversations in the Dark.
Talk, let's have conversations in the dark. World is sleeping, I'm awake with you. With you. Why? Movies that we both already seen. I ain't even looking at the screen. It's true. I've got my eyes on you.
And you say, John Legend, tell us about this one because it feels very personal when you listen to it.
Well, absolutely. It's about those intimate moments you have in your relationship with your partner, your loved one. You know, those moments when you tell your secrets, you have those intimate conversations. And, you know, I think one of the things that I like to do in my songs is talk about those personal moments, but also make songs that are really universal because everybody has those kinds of feelings and those kinds of moments in their lives.
Well, and you've said that this entire album is largely inspired by your wife, Chrissy Teigen.
Quite a bit of it is. Some of it, you know, is about other situations in my life, but, you know, I think it's important for artists to write from their own experience. It helps you write authentically and write in a way that really cuts through.
How has life been with the two of you and your two kids during the pandemic?
You know, we've made the most of it. I think, obviously, we're very fortunate. We have plenty of resources and, you know, we have a pool in the backyard. And Chrissy's so creative with them and finding ways to keep them entertained. And I would have never been able to spend this much time with my kids, I think, pretty much ever, if this pandemic hadn't happened. And so that's one of the silver linings.
Are they musical yet?
They definitely love music. They love singing along to the records that I play for them, whether it's my own record or, you know, records from the Disney movies they like. We have dance parties with them, just the four of us. And it's hard to tell if they'll be actually good at performing any of it yet or if they'll take an interest in learning an instrument or learning to sing, but clearly they love music.
Yeah, I have to say, as the child of two classical pianists, I had to decide at a young age, being probably 12 or 13, that I was never going to be as good as them. So it was time to find another profession.
Yeah, it's interesting when you have parents that do what we do in such a high profile way, you know, how you figure out your own thing and what excites you and what you're passionate about. And I want to give them as much freedom as possible to explore and figure out what they really love. But also, I think it's important that once they do figure that out, that someone in their lives tells them that they can't take shortcuts to getting good at it. They have to spend some time on it, work hard, and the best people at any profession usually have some innate talent, but they spend a lot of time cultivating it as well.
You do have a 20-year-old guest musician on this album, one of a number of guest musicians, and that is the Jamaican reggae singer Koffi, who appears on the song Don't Walk Away. Let's listen to a little bit of that. There's so much more I want to say. Take time, fragile is my love. Yeah. I ain't ever giving up. Yeah. Give you my life, I would. I'll stand by you. Bad times and good. I can't really cope like this. When you say you don't know me, oh, I can't we slow things down. Won't you put your love on me? Yeah. When we touch the road, give me one phone call. Now, she's only 20 years old, but she is already a Grammy winner. Tell us about why you decided to collaborate with her and what you think she brings to your music.
Well, I decided to collaborate with her before the Grammys, but I got a chance to meet her during Grammy weekend this year, and she won Best Reggae Album, and she's the first female artist to ever win Best Reggae Album. She's also the youngest artist ever to win Best Reggae Album, so she's truly a young phenom. And when I made this song, I made it with a guy named Stephen McGregor, who goes by the name of DeGenius. I was thinking it would be great to feature a Jamaican artist on the song. And Koffi was, you know, she was coming up and she was doing big things and getting a lot of buzz. And I listened to a bit of her work and was like, she's the perfect person. And so I was planning to reach out to her, but I happened to meet her at the Grammys. And I told her, oh, we have this song I really want you to be a part of. And she graced us with her presence.
I know that when you were much younger, you got to work with Lauryn Hill. Did this feel like you were on the other side of that this time?
Well, you know, with Lauryn, she didn't even know who I was when I walked in the studio. I was just a friend of a friend and was hanging out. She didn't know I was a musician yet until like the middle of the session. So I was truly plucked from obscurity when she asked me to play the piano and Everything Is Everything. So I wasn't nearly as far along as Koffi is now, as she guests on my album. And, you know, I feel very fortunate that Koffi agreed to do it. Her name means a lot in the world of folks that listen to Caribbean music.
I just want to briefly ask you about politics, because just days ago you appeared at a big fundraiser for Joe Biden. Yeah. What are you thinking about as we head into this election in November?
Well, I'm hoping, you know, America makes the right decision. We've seen, 3.5 years of chaos and division and bigotry and poor leadership has wrought. And it's abundantly clear that Trump cannot get a second term.
Well, what do you say to young people, especially who maybe supported Bernie Sanders in the primary, who don't believe Joe Biden is going to bring real change for them and maybe won't show up to vote for him?
I really believe we don't have the luxury of being that picky. I didn't support Biden in the primary. I supported Elizabeth Warren. But the Democratic Party, the people that comprise the Democratic Party and showed up for these primary elections and caucuses, they chose Joe Biden. And I think Joe Biden has done a really good job of reaching out to the left side of the Democratic Party and incorporating a lot of their ideas that he wasn't trumpeting before.
Do you think he should pick Warren as his VP?
I think she would be a great choice, but I also think there are other great choices. But I believe the VP isn't as important as all the other cabinet officials and advisors that he has on his team, because what that will show, Elizabeth Warren always says, personnel is policy. And I think that's a good way to look at it, because not only is he going to be asking a VP to campaign with him, but he's going to be hiring a Treasury Secretary and a Attorney General and you know, all these folks that are going to have a lot of sway in the policies of his government. And it might even be useful for Vice President Biden to, in advance of the election, let people know what kinds of people he's looking to bring on in those positions.
Do you ever want to get into politics yourself?
I am into politics right now. I feel like the way
run for office, though?
The way that I'm involved. I do not want to run for office. I use my position and my platform to try to be a part of the conversation in a major way.
And I'll continue to do that. And I don't want to run for office.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours. It will be ours. Oh, one day.
I want to ask you one more thing, because you are one of only 16 people in the world to have scored an EGOT, winning
yes,
an Emmy,
just had
a Grammy.
New, club member inducted.
Oh, really? A new club member. Okay. Do you guys meet? Do you have
it was
regular meetings?
Before this week, and Alan Menken just got, I believe, an Emmy, and now it's 16.
And you guys don't have dinner parties or anything like that?
We don't. We did kind of a faux EGOT thing for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, but it wasn't a true convening of all the EGOTs that are alive.
Well, what does that mean to you to have won all of those awards?
Oh, well, it's obviously a huge honor and puts me in very rare company. What it makes me really think about is the projects that helped me get there, not only the albums I've made to win Grammys, but, you know, being a part of the movie Selma with Common, and being part of a really fun production of Jesus Christ Superstar. Those are the memories I have whenever I think about winning an EGOT, and it makes me feel really grateful and fortunate that I've been able to do the kinds of things I've been able to do in my career.
That is John Legend, whose latest album is called Bigger Love. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I want to drive you.
And because of the pandemic, the tour for John Legend's new album will not take place until next year. You're listening to Here and Now.
Yeah, I wanna drive you. Wow, wow, wow.
Lord & Taylor is the latest iconic retailer to file for bankruptcy. It follows on the heels of stores like Brooks Brothers, J. Crew, Neiman Marcus, and JCPenney this year. Meanwhile, Congress is still at odds over the next coronavirus relief package. So lots to talk about with Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Well, let's start with that relief bill, because a lot of unemployed Americans are waiting to see what happens there. The expanded unemployment benefits expired on Friday. Democrats want to continue them at $600 a week. Republicans want that figure to be less. What are you hearing about whether and when they'll reach a deal?
Well, evidently from our reporting at CBS News that right now the White House wants to narrowly focus on getting this enhanced unemployment and also the eviction relief. Remember, there's also a moratorium on eviction for renters, and they want those to be the two big parts that they focus on. But House Speaker Pelosi has basically said there's not going to be a short-term deal. There's no little side deal on these things, and then we get to it. She wants the larger package. So as we know, the Republicans came out and said $200 per week would be the added benefit. As you noted, $600 is where the Republicans, where the Democrats are. You know, interesting, there is some pickup on this idea where we could have some automatic triggers that are pegged to the unemployment rate of a specific state. That may mm-hmm. say, well, if, you know, unemployment's at 12%, it's 600, but if it drops to 8%, it goes down. So we'll see. It does not look great for any deal today or tomorrow, at least.
Well, and what about the argument Republicans have been making, which is that $600 extra is a disincentive for people to go back to work because they're making more on unemployment than they would at their job? Do we know whether that's actually true?
Well, I think that when the unemployment rate is hovering at 11%, it's really difficult to say that's why someone's staying home. Now, again, under the unemployment rules, if you are offered your job back, you're supposed to take it and give up your unemployment check. I don't know what kind of oversight there is of the program mm-hmm. at this point. But look, there's not a great deal of upside for people to just stay home. People want to work. So the reality is the $600 number came up that they came up with early on was about median household income. And the virus is disproportionately impacting folks who make less than $40,000, not the $60,000 or $65,000 that's median. That's the overshoot. The good news is people at the lower end of the income stream tend to spend the money they receive as stimulus in the economy.
We mentioned Lord & Taylor. That was a company, by the way, founded in 1826, now filing for bankruptcy, yet another big retailer. But there's something else going on, Jill, I want to ask you about. The dollar is starting to lose value. It's down 10% against other currencies since March. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells us that the global community that looks at the economies around the world and makes investments based on that believes that the U.S. caseload is ballooning at a time where other parts of the world, specifically in Europe and parts of Asia, those cases are being diminished. So there's a couple of things, which is, gosh, the economy in the U.S. will stay weaker for longer. That means the Fed will keep rates at zero for longer. But also, it could mean that there are some people who are worried about deficits in the future and that there will be a big problem with the dollar down the line. But for right now, the economy being mired in a recession is really keeping a clamping lid down on that dollar value right now.
That is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Take care.
The $600 a week federal jobless benefit has now expired, and it's expected that there will be an increased need for SNAP benefits, previously called food stamps, to make ends meet. In Mississippi, one of the nation's poorest states, 15% of the population already relied on these benefits before the pandemic, and now the state is bracing for a surge in new applications. Bob Anderson is the executive director of the Mississippi Department of Human Services, and he joins us now to talk about the challenges states like his are now facing. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So, Bob, you were sworn into this position in March, and man, this was just a week before many of the country shut down because of the pandemic. Given this, what are some of the immediate changes you had to take on to make sure families and low-income people were prepared? Human services is a huge economic driver in the state. How is the department reshifting to address the new needs during this pandemic?
Well, one of the things we had to immediately address was how to handle just the extraordinary volume, increase in volume of applications, particularly for SNAP. In about a two-and-a-half-week period between March 16th and April 7th, we saw 68,500 new applications, and we had to shift our employees' work schedules to put them on 12-hour days and six-day weeks in order to just handle that volume, because we have to register applications, then we have to make the eligibility determination, and that's a continuous process that is required before we can begin to push SNAP benefits out the new recipients.
You mentioned the sheer number of applicants for benefits soon after our country was hit with this pandemic. What have you been hearing from families directly? What's the greatest struggles many of them are facing right now?
Oh, gosh, I think probably the one that that keeps me awake at night the most and one that we hear the most about is what's going to happen? What do families do once those unemployment benefits end, and those have come to an end, and we don't know what, you know, what's in store. What's the next step? What's the next stimulus package coming from Capitol Hill? And where? How much longer? We just got approval to continue doing supplemental SNAP benefits through August, and that's going to help, but we don't know what comes after August. And I think the uncertainty is the thing that we're hearing the most about, and I certainly understand that.
Yeah, I know that many states are dealing with this same problem, just the overload of need and also the processes in place to be able to meet those needs. Your team recently offered SNAP households a supplement for the month of August, but your department has been criticized by some advocates for focusing a lot on self-sufficiency programs. What is your response to this? Do you think states should continue to focus on these kinds of programs or move towards more direct funding?
Well, that's a dialogue that we have begun since I got here. We've not revisited our direct assistance, particularly for temporary assistance to needy families, in quite a while. And we're probably at the near the bottom in terms of the amount that we've support families. And that's a dialogue we are beginning to have internally. We'll also be having it with the governor's staff to look at whether Mississippi needs to, you know, consider shifting from supportive services to more direct assistance. That's certainly something I'm open to considering as executive director.
I understand that you're open to dialogue, but what do you see as the benefits of direct assistance over supportive programs, or really vice versa?
Well, I think there's a real place for the workforce development work that we do and preparing people for the workplace. But I think we also have to step back and think about what do we do to prepare people to even be prepared to start getting into the workforce. Because it, just saying you need to be in workforce development or work training without preparing them with some of these these training programs to teach people how to be prepared to go for an interview, for example, and knowing how to how to comport themselves in an interview and all of those related issues are a significant benefit of the supportive services. But I've been saying around here that I think if we could provide sort of a head start to folks in the sense of paying a little bit more in terms of direct assistance at the beginning of their crisis period and helping them then to get ready to look at entering the workforce, then we may not have the experience of having them stay on the assistance as long as some are forced to do right now. But that's just a different way of thinking, and I'm hoping I can, get some traction with that idea.
Yeah. My understanding also is that for many of these programs, especially SNAP, the federal supplementary benefit made it so that people no longer qualified for the state-administered benefits. As those federal benefits now come to an end, how are you preparing for a renewed surge in applicants? Do you have enough funds and the systems in place to actually meet those new demands?
I think we're good with funds. We haven't had an issue with shortage of funds, but we're going to have to look at our workload again. One of the other things we had to do is we normally work these applications county by county, and some counties were just absolute hotspots in terms of large volume of applications. And so we went to a combined workload where, smaller adjacent county that didn't have as much pressure on them to take more applications, we would assign cases to that county to work a common workload. And we're going to have to go back to that for sure. The other problem we ran into with the unemployment that was really frustrating is that a lot of our folks who were getting the pandemic unemployment assistance at $600 a week, that automatically disqualified them for SNAP.
Right.
We asked the Food and Nutrition Service to give us a waiver, at least for the first month, so we could let people know that if you're accepting the unemployment benefits, it's probably going to disqualify you for SNAP assistance. And we just we hit a brick wall with FNS and just couldn't, the Food and Nutrition Service. And now we're having to work disqualifications. And in the middle of the pandemic, which continues, as executive director, that's been one of my greatest frustrations.
What do you need? What are you asking for? What would you like for? Is it the federal government or other entities to help and assist in this growing problem in the state of Mississippi?
Well, I think, there's always this problem of unintended consequences. And I certainly understand the decision to put supplemental unemployment assistance at $600 a week, because that has helped families all over the nation. And I am fully supportive of that. But I think we need to think more strategically in terms of how does that impact our other benefit services, because what happens is, what's going to happen for these folks, they're going to fall off what we call around here a benefit cliff. They're going to be back applying for SNAP benefits and trying to qualify for TANF benefits, and they may well be still in one of those disqualification periods. And so we need all of the federal partners we deal with to have some interactive discussions about the consequences of the choices they're making. And I just haven't seen a lot of that interactive dialogue among our federal partners.
You entered this position knowing that you would have to win back the trust of the people you serve. Your predecessor is accused of embezzling millions of dollars away from needy families to fund personal ventures. There was a story about a luxury rehab stay in California. What measures have you put in place to one, gain back public trust, and then two, increase transparency on how funds are allocated?
I've started what I've called around here Operation Restore Trust, because I just think that's where we are. We have to restore public trust and confidence in this agency. We have to be moving toward excellence. If we're going to regain public confidence, we have to live out integrity, we have to practice compliance, and we have to move toward excellence. And those are the three core values that I have been preaching, so to speak, since I got here.
That's Bob Anderson, Executive Director of Mississippi's Department of Human Services. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
As Hurricane Isaias makes its way up the East Coast, it'll be encountering record warm water temperatures. Today, the ocean off of Tolchester Beach, Maryland is 84.2 degrees. The average for this time of year is 80. Off Woods Hole, Massachusetts, it's 75.6 degrees. The average 72. And off of Eastport, Maine, it's 52.7 degrees, warmer than the average temperature there, which is 51 this time of year. Joining us now is Glenn Gaworkiewicz, who's an oceanographer at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He joins us by Skype. Glenn, welcome.
It's nice to be here.
Well, and how unusual are these water temperatures that we're seeing along the East Coast right now?
Well, we do have a marine heat wave right now. And I just checked this morning, and most of the Northeast has about a 3 to 4 degree Fahrenheit temperature anomaly. In recent years, we've been getting more of these marine heat waves. But I think that this year it's particularly worrisome because we may have a more active than usual hurricane season.
Mm-hmm. And why is it so warm this year?
We have not done the analysis yet to understand the exact causal factors. But the area south of New England and to some extent the Gulf of Maine is really being forced by two large-scale features. In the atmosphere, we have the jet stream, and that's been changing its behavior over the last 10 years or so. Weather patterns tend to be slowing down, for example, and that changes the exchange of heat between the ocean and the atmosphere. And then also we have the Gulf Stream offshore, and the Gulf Stream has been putting out a lot more eddies called warm core rings. And so the shelf in general has been a lot more affected by offshore forcing bringing warm water. It's a very interesting time now, and we're really working hard to try and figure out the causes from season to season and year to year.
But overall, there's no doubt that there's a trend going on, an overall warming in this region, right? And possibly and probably connected to climate change.
Absolutely. Now, that is definitely true. And this region off of New England is certainly one of the fastest warming regions in the world oceans. And it is because of our geographic location with the jet stream. Shifts in the jet stream position in the winter or a late retreat in the fall, for example, can really change those air-sea fluxes. And of course, you can have preconditioning as well, where anomalies from the season before tend to persist.
Now, we just saw the first fatal shark attack in the history of the state of Maine, at least in the recorded history of the state of Maine. We don't know if that's connected to the warmer waters, although it wouldn't be out of the question for it to be so. What do the warmer waters mean for ocean life, as far as you know?
There's an opening to the continental slope, the Northeast Channel, and these warm core rings I talked about earlier. When they come near that Northeast Channel, there's an inflow on the northern side of it, and warm core ring water can actually go into the Gulf of Maine. And then that tends to bring in species that are more commonly associated with the Gulf Stream there. We do not know what role, if any, the ring water in the Gulf of Maine right now played in that shark attack, But recent research has shown that great white sharks do use warm core rings for feeding. And so there is a possible connection.
And you mentioned that this could kind of supercharge the hurricane season. What are you looking at in terms of the weather effects of this warmer water this year?
One of the things that protects southern New England from the most intense storms is that there's a layer of cold water underneath the surface water. And when storms pass by, they can mix that colder water into the surface layer. And so the sea surface temperature can then cool off and weaken the storms. But what concerns me for this year is a graduate student, Lucas Lobert, has been looking at ocean observatory data at the edge of the continental shelf south of New England. And the ocean is both warmer and it's also much fresher this year. And that makes very large density differences between that surface layer and that cold layer underneath. And that can reduce the mixing of that cold water.
We've got a map at hereandnow.org of the latest sort of August 3rd difference in sea surface temperature from normal. And you certainly see a lot of dark red just off of New England, but you also see a lot of dark red further up towards Greenland. That's got to be pretty concerning too, just given the ice melt that we've already seen.
A vessel from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, the Neil Armstrong, recently returned from a cruise off of Greenland. So that is another process that we're studying. You're exactly right. Melt rates are a great concern up in the Labrador Sea.
That is Glenn Gawerkiewicz, who is an oceanographer at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Glenn, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The October surprise, announcing a possible Vietnam peace deal days before the 1972 election, or back in October 2016 when former FBI Director James Comey said this.
I'm here to give you an update on the FBI's investigation of Secretary Clinton's use of a personal email system during her time as Secretary of State.
The history of October surprises, next time on Here and Now.